Okay, I think I'll get started. So, three organizational announcements. So next week is a workshop on classification of C-star algebras, so we won't meet next week, but we'll continue 2 weeks from today, which I think is the 22nd. And then we'll have a lecture. Roland's going to give a lecture on free entropy. He was going to give it this week, but he couldn't get up here this week, so we had to change the schedule a little bit. The fourth assignment we had to change the plans a little bit, so we're a little slow about getting the assignment up. About assignment three, Tao asked me, was trying to figure out how to do the last part about finding the Marchenko-Pasteur distribution. So I'll just say a word about this. Remember, Stoci's inversion theorem says that if you start with a probability measure, and you define the Cauchy transform to be g of z is the integral over the whole real line, and here we're assuming that the imaginary part of z is positive, then you can recover the measure by the Stoltz inversion formula, which says that if you take the integral from a to b of minus 1 over pi times the imaginary part of g of x plus iy, you integrate x going from a to b, and you take the limit as y goes to 0 from above, then this is going to give you the measure of the interval that you started with. And so this says each atom, in this integral here, you pick up one half of the measure of each atom plus the whole measure of the open interval. And I did an example with the semicircle law. And it worked out pretty nicely. It worked out nicely because you could move by the dominated convergence theorem this limit inside the integral. And then, so when we made up the homework, we said, what about the Marchenko-Pasteur? Well, it turns out that that trick works on part of the spectrum, but in the other part of the spectrum, it doesn't work, because the Cauchy transform has a pole at the origin. And so Tao came and asked me on Tuesday, he said, dominated convergence doesn't quite do it. So what you have to do is, at least it seems to me, is to use the residue theorem. I don't know if everybody noticed that, but the spectrum lives away from the origin, and you're really trying to estimate the contribution of this little mass here. So you're trying to integrate along a little interval that's going to from the little to the left and the right of the origin that will capture this mass here, and you're going to let that line drop down. So what you do is you make a little box going around the origin, and the integral along the bottom plus the integral along the top is just twice the imaginary part of what you're trying to calculate. And then the integral along the edges, okay, I didn't check this out, but it looks like it goes to zero. So, and the residue is going to be is 2 pi I times the thing that you were hoping to calculate. And so the 2 times the imaginary part here cancels off one of that 2, and this pi cancels off that other thing, and it just works out just right. So I don't know if everybody figured that out on their own, but I'm just offering that as a hint to anybody that wants a little extra time to finish off the calculation. I don't know if Roland realized he had to do this, but I didn't realize he had to do this extra trick. So I was assuming it was just like the calculation I did in the lecture. Okay, there's a little bit more to it. But anyway, it turns out it's sort of a standard technique. Okay, so this lecture is going to be about fluctuations of random matrices. And second order freeness. So second order freeness is a new part of free probability theory that Rowland and I and Jetra Snyder and Benoit Collins have been working on for the last few years. And the idea of second order freeness is to be able to do the same kind of calculations for fluctuations that first order freeness allows you to do for moments. So just let me remind you how that goes. So the two computational problems that free probability solves are the following. If you have two operators, say A and B, and they're free from each other, and you know the moments of A and you know the moments of B, then R transform tells you how to calculate the moments of the sum. S transform tells you how to calculate the moments of the product. We haven't talked about the S transform, but the idea is that if you know the moments, then there's a formula for calculating the cumulants. So if you know the moments of A and then the moments of B, then you know the cumulants of each of them. Then freeness says the cumulants of the sum are the sum of the cumulants. So that means you know the cumulants of the sum, and then you take the inverse, and then you've got the moments of A and B. So the sum of A and B. So and there's a similar theorem for products using what's called the F-transform. And so that's the main computational part of free probability, is to enable those calculations. And so that means anything that's built up out of addition and multiplication, in principle, is computable, although the formulas can get pretty complicated as you go along. Under certain classes of things, you stay in the category where the Cauchy transforms satisfy a polynomial identity. And that if that's the case, then that sort of makes it machine computable at least. So you can't find things exactly, but you can do it numerically on your computer at least and get pictures of what's happening to the densities of these various self-adjoint operators. So sometimes you can solve the polynomial equations exactly, but generally you can't. So if Rowland gave a lecture last week about block matrices, and that's a case when you can work out the theoretical side pretty easily, but then you have to solve some matrix quadratic equations, and I don't think, as far as I know, you can't do that exactly. But you can do it numerically, and so if you have actual examples, then usually you can work out the answer numerically. But you can't find a closed formula for the densities. Okay, so what I want to tell you first is what are fluctuations, and then I'll tell you what second order freeness is, and probably that'll use up to 2 hours. Okay, so let's just go back to the simplest case. So we're calling GUE random matrix. So X is an n by n matrix. and X is self-adjoint. And that's just, we recall how it goes. So if we write X, the matrix entries is Fij, and we look at the Fij and we write them as their real and imaginary parts, then the assumptions are that if you take all of the Xij where I is less than or equal to J, and you union that with the Yijs where I is strictly less than J, because on the diagonal Y is 0 because it's a self-adjoint matrix, this is independent set of centered Gaussian random variables. And the last thing is you have to normalize them in a way so that when the size of the matrix goes to infinity, things have limits. And the normalization is the variance of the diagonal elements is 1 over n. And the complex variance of the off-diagonal elements is also 1 over n, but the real and imaginary parts have the same weight. So let me just write it like this. Xij squared is equal to the variance of yij squared is 1 over 2n for I different than j. Now, way back in the very first lecture, we went through the calculation that if you take f, a polynomial, and you you take the normalized trace of f of x n, okay, that's a random variable, and this converges almost surely to a constant random variable, namely the the integral of the polynomial against Wigner's semicircle law. Okay. Now, so if you choose a polynomial such that the integral is zero, okay, then this random variable converges to zero almost surely. Okay, but something surprising happens if you multiply it by n, then, and in other words, as it goes down to zero, you rescale it out, it actually converges to a random variable. However, so multiplying it by n means you take the normalized trace and turn it into the unnormalized trace. This converges to a Gaussian random variable. That's a theorem. Okay, and so for every polynomial we have these random variables. For every polynomial satisfying this condition, and what we want to do is study how these covariances of these random variables, how they depend on F and the original matrix. So these are called the fluctuations. of xn, so this is a loose definition, is the study of the covariances in the limit. Of this family of random variables. So we're always assuming that it's a centered random variable. The expectation of this is going to be zero. Okay, so the simplest polynomials to look at are just powers. So in particular, you can look at, just like with moments, we like to reduce it to looking at some numbers. So that alpha pq be the limit as n goes to infinity. We're going to look at the moments, the covariances of these random variables in the special case where f of x is x to the p, and then we have to subtract off what the expectation is. So let's say we just, so this is, I mean, these are just the moments of the semicircle law. Okay, so we take the trace of x to the p times the trace of x to the q, and then we subtract off the product of the expectations. Okay, so I'm not certain if this is standard or not, but Roland and I have been calling these the fluctuation moments. Of a semicircle. That's correct, yeah. So, that's right. But this seems to be the natural ones to assign the semi. So, in second order free probability, you have to assign fluctuation moments to certain operators. So, I don't know if you can choose them completely independently, but all the examples that we've studied, the way we assigned the fluctuation moments was to choose an interesting sequence of operators of random matrices that people are studying that converge to that. So Menger's exactly right that this is a bit of our own invention to say these are the fluctuation moments of a semicircular operator, but it seems like a reasonable choice of terminology. Okay, so the very first thing I want to do is study these numbers. Okay, so because these numbers have a very simple combinatorial interpretation. Just like the non-crossing pairings did for the moments of the semicircle. And okay, so let me just state this as a theorem first, and then we'll try and explain how it works. Alpha PQ equals the number of non-crossing pairings of a PQ annulus. Okay, so I haven't said what those are. Let me just give them some examples. Okay, so the simplest case is when P and Q are equal to 1, and this thing just converges to 1. That's right, yeah. For this alpha PQ right here. I should also say, it turns out that this example and one other example coming from Wishart matrices seem to be the ones that are really worth studying the most, because they, two things happen. One is they serve as a model for what happens in general. And at least in the case of these pairings, properties of this one actually have implications for more general classes of random variables because of a universality result of Johansson.
Yeah.
And
my impression is that this kind of quantity was appeared in the study of Makulauri, and I don't remember exactly, but such kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
For some general polynomial or
something. That's right. Yeah, so I think in the... I haven't looked at these papers in the physics literature, but it was noticed that if you do more general potentials here, where you have unitary invariant ensembles, you always get the same fluctuations. So you don't get the semicircle law as the limit, you get something related to a semicircle law, but the fluctuations are always the same. And so that's in the physics literature, I don't know if it was proved or not anyway, but about 10 years ago, Kurt Johansson gave a mathematical proof of that. And I don't know, I'm not certain what physics people think about it. But anyway. So, in fact, I think in the physics literature, this fact here, maybe it was a folklore theorem, I don't know. I found a few papers where they said things like this. I mean, they didn't write the pictures this way. And one of the things that's tricky in this business is that there are a bunch of papers and everybody has their own way of drawing the pictures. And sometimes it's obvious that the pictures are counting the same thing. Sometimes it's the theorem that they're counting the same thing. And so, depending on how the pictures are drawn. Roland and I came to discover this sort of naively without knowing about these other papers, so we like our pictures best. So that's what I'm going to show you. So here's the idea. You have two circles, one inside the other. And you put P dots on one circle, Q dots on the other circle, and then you have to connect up the dots so that the lines don't cross, and there's at least one line passing between the two circles. Okay? Only one such diagram in this case. It's easy to check that the sum of P and Q has to be even, or that limit is zero. Okay? When you do you can write down an explicit formula for this thing without the limit, and it's very easy to see. You get zero even before you take the limit if P and Q are not of the same parity. So the next possibility is alpha 2, 2. Okay? That's the next. There's no alpha 1, 2, that's zero. So that means you put... And it turns out this number is 2. Then, so we put 2 points on each circle, and we've got to connect up the points with lines that don't cross, such that at least one line connects the two circles. So you can see there's just two possibilities. Either you do this and this, or you switch the two things around in the middle. Okay, So that's it. I think I'll do one more example because these ones are a little bit too simple. Okay, I think Alpha 1-3. No, I didn't do one. Let's do Alpha 1-3 is too easy. Let's do Alpha 2-4. Just to have. Okay, Alpha 2-4 turns out to be 8. So there's going to be 8 pictures. I'm numbering the points. Actually, the numbering the points is not relevant. So some of you that were at the planar algebra talks that we've had over the earlier this term, in the planar algebra business, you just put a little notch to indicate where the starting point on that circle is. And I mean, that's an equivalent thing. If you number the points, though, actually something, you can do something which for some reason they don't want to do in planar algebras. You can turn this combinatorial thing into an algebraic thing. And the importance to make everything, the calculations come out nicely, it's important that if you orient the two circles in opposite directions. You don't have to, it's just that the algebra will get very messy if you don't. But if you do this, then the algebra comes out to be quite simple. So let's draw some... Okay, I mean, you can see both points on this outer circle have to be connected to the inner circle. You decide where the first one goes, and then there's two possibilities for where the bottom one goes. If one is connected to 3, you can't connect 2 to 5, because then you can't draw a line going between 4 and 6 without crossing a line. Okay. So, and let's see, okay, well actually maybe I don't need to draw the rest of the diagrams because look, you see there's 4 possibilities for connecting 1 to the inner circle. And for each of those possibilities, there's 2 other possibilities for connecting 2. 4 times 2 is 8, that's it. Okay, maybe that's enough. Everybody happy with that? Okay, so these are the diagrams. And you can write down an explicit formula for what these numbers are. Although it's a bit like writing down the formula for the Catalan numbers. It's useful for computing small values, but it isn't very useful for understanding the structure. Okay, now I said that there's a... Let me describe an algebraic way of understanding these pairings. So, in the subfactor literature, they always talk about homotopy classes and stuff, where you're allowed to deform the strings and so on. In this case, you can actually just describe it entirely in terms of the permutation group. And then you have to convince yourself that the two descriptions are the same. So here's the idea. So you take each one of these pairings and you write down which things are actually... You write down the blocks. So we have 1 and 3 are connected. and we have 2 and 4 are connected, and we have 5 and 6 are connected. So that's a way of writing down what the pairing is. And what we want is a way, if you're given the blocks, a way of detecting whether or not a planar diagram actually exists. Okay, because I mean, right now it's pretty easy when there's only a few points, but when you get to a lot of points, you can spend a lot of time trying to just figure out whether no diagram exists, or you just haven't tried hard enough to find it. Okay, so here's the idea. The first thing you do is just exactly what we did in the case of the semicircle law. We immediately think of our partition as a permutation. So we think of this as an element in S6. Okay, and it's a product of 3 transpositions. 1 gets switched with 3, 2 gets switched with 4, and 5 gets switched with 6. And there's another permutation, sort of a base permutation, which we're going to call gamma 2, 4, and it's the permutation that has 2 cycles. 1 and 2 get switched, and then 3 goes to 4 goes to 5, 5 goes to 6, and 6 goes back to 3. So it's just essentially the points on the outer circle and the points on the inner circle. And there's a theorem, and it's hard to really give a precise attribution for this theorem because it seems there's many little discoveries and sort of forgotten and rediscovered and so on, and probably but my little historical research indicates that there's 2 people involved, Aranjac and Robert Curie, who curiously were all in Paris at the same time that Cleveras was doing his non-crossing partitions, but nobody seems to have known about what the other people were doing. But they don't refer to each other. Maybe they knew each other and didn't like each other, I don't know. Okay, but it goes like this. It says that if you have any 2 elements of the symmetric group, so they don't have to be these particular ones here, then there's a certain equation. If you have 2 elements of the symmetric group such that the subgroup, I'm just going to write it like this, that's the subgroup generated by those 2 elements, acts transitively. On the integers from 1 up to n. That means you can find something, some element in the group that will take any element to any other element. Then there exists a positive integer g, which is going to be a certain genus, such that the number of cycles in pi plus the number of cycles in gamma pi inverse plus the number of cycles in gamma is equal to n plus 2 times 1 minus g. Okay, and there's an additional part. This is and this number g, so maybe I won't try and give the full statement, but let's set it like this. And g is equal to 0 if and only if, let me just speak loosely because I don't want to get into the details, is a planar pair. Okay, so let me, what does that mean? It means you take the cycles of gamma And each one you make into a circle in the plane. And then you visit the points according to the cycles of pi. And if you can draw all that on a sphere, then you say it's planar. Okay, now we're going to do the special case where gamma has only two cycles and pi is a product of transpositions. And so you get zero only when you can put a drawing like this on a sphere. Well, we can imagine this board is the whole sphere and we've just forgotten about the back of it. Okay, so this little theorem, which actually goes back to works in topology and so on, mappings on spheres and so on, back to the 20s. Reduces all of this drawing problem to a problem about counting cycles. So in the whole business, you just count cycles. You never worry about, you use this theorem to tell you what the planar things are. So that's sort of a crucial observation, is that you turn it into a problem in the symmetric group. And really these diagrams are enable you to visualize things, but in general you don't use them to prove things. Because this theory, usually the best proofs are the ones where you can just reduce it to a calculation. Of course, when you do reduce it to a calculation, you can be certain that it's correct, but you don't actually see why it works. And to see why it works, you go back to the diagram. Okay. So that's how we convert. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Well, I think it's this. Yeah. Well, I'm going to actually talk about the genus expansion in a second, but I think in the physics literature, they knew about this. I don't know. I mean, they just say it's planar, and so what. Unless you go and find that person that wrote it, it's hard to tell what. But anyway, let's talk about the genus expansion. Okay, so here's the theorem. Okay, I think I can. So we're back up in this case here, the GUE, and so the theorem is this. Just like in the case of the calculating the expectations of the trace of a power, we can also calculate the covariance of of traces of powers. So we can calculate in the case of the GUE, we can do an exact calculation for a finite n. It's going to be a sum over all pairings of P plus Q. So P plus Q has to be even, or this sum will be zero. And it's going to be N. You take the number of, and the exponent of N is going to be the number of cycles of gamma PQ times pi minus P plus Q divided by 2. Gamma PQ is exactly this. So gamma PQ, in general, is going to be 1, 2, up to P, times P plus 1, up to P plus Q. It will be a permutation with two cycles, P points on one circle, Q points on the other circle.
Uh-huh. So the equation is very similar.
Yeah. Well, I think it's all the same equation, just written differently. I don't know, actually, but let's take the information of this equation on the bottom and put it in here. So what do we know? We know that the number of cycles of gamma PQ pi minus P plus Q over 2 is just equal to negative 2G. Okay, because pi is a pairing, the number of cycles of pi is P plus Q over 2. So when you move this, bring this over, you get a P plus Q over 2. This thing has two cycles, this is a 2, so that kills that thing, and all that's left is a negative 2G. So you could write this as the sum of N to the minus 2G, well, 2G, it depends on pi, times the sum for this it's this particular the integer that applies to that particular pi. Okay. So once you have this formula, if you believe this formula, then you see this converges to alpha PQ. Because only the pi's where g is equal to 0 will survive on the limit. Everything else goes to 0. And the non-crossing ones are exactly the ones where your g is a 0. Yeah.
In this, I don't exactly see why, how it excludes those that connect the outer circle with itself and the inner circle.
Yeah. Okay, let me explain that a little bit. Okay, I mean, there's a philosophical reason why this should be true, and that is this is a covariance. The covariance comes from taking a logarithm, and in combinatorics, when you take the logarithm of the generating function, you just get the connected objects. Okay, so that's sort of the philosophical reason why it should work. But I mean, here's the and I guess in the physics literature, that's all you have to say. But how do you? I mean, here, let's make a little lemma. Let's just take, let's look at the first term of that covariance. Yeah, actually now I see, I realize I made a mistake here. I left something out. So subconnected means at least one pair goes between the two circles. Okay. It's good that you asked that, otherwise. Because if you... Say it again. Yeah, I'll just try and show you how you do this calculation. Yeah, it's actually a very simple calculation. Okay, so if you just take the first term, you get the sum over all pairings. When you subtract off these two things, you remove the disconnected ones, and only the connected ones remain. Okay, So the thing you're summing is the same in each case, whether you're in this case or in this case. In the case when it's the expectation of the product, you sum over all pairings, and when it's the product of the expectations, you sum over pairings which are made by taking a pairing of the first on the first circle and a pairing of the second circle, but no strings go between the two circles. And so then when you take the difference, only the connected ones remain. And these two calculations are exactly the same. The proof is exactly the same. It comes from the Wick product formula. The Wick formula. So let's just look at the first one. Okay, so we write that as a great big sum of the expectation of Fi1, I2, up to Fipi1, Fip plus 1, Ip plus 2, Fip plus Q, Ip plus 1. So the fact that this thing loops back to the beginning is because I have a trace of x to the p. Okay, and this is the sum I1 up to Ip plus Q. Okay. So we use the Wick formula, so it's the sum I1 up to Ip plus Q, going from 1 up to n, and each one of these things, each term here is going to be, there's this normalization constant, n to the minus p plus q over 2, that comes out from the way we normalized a random matrix to start with, times the number of pairings of p plus q. So remember, what we have to do is we have to count the number of ways that you can pair a pair of elements such that one of them is the adjoint of the other, the complex conjugate of the other. So we count the number of pairings such that whenever you take a pair in your pairing, this implies that I sub R is equal to I sub S plus 1, and I sub S equals I sub R plus 1. So let me just draw a little picture here. So we're taking FIR, IR plus 1, and we're saying we want to pair that with FIS, IS plus 1. So that will be, we'll get 0 unless these outer indices are equal and the inner indices are equal. Now, I've swept something under the carpet a little bit here. Sometimes you don't always take S plus 1. For example, if you pair the first and the last guy, well, then you see I1 always equals I1. So actually, what we really should put here, what we really want is I sub R is I of gamma P comma Q of S. Because normally gamma just bumps it up by 1, except when you get to the end, then this is not P plus 1 here, this is a 1. So you have to use your gamma to record where the things get wrapped around. And this is the same as saying I sub S is equal to I of gamma P comma Q of R. So it's the same calculation as I did in the very first lecture, except there I just had one cycle in my gamma, the one that wraps around at the end. Now I want to do it with two cycles, but that's the only difference. Okay, but now we can write this. So the sum, I1 up to Ip plus Q, going from 1 up to n, n to the minus p plus q divided by 2, and here we count the number are pairings that satisfy a certain equation. So this is the crucial thing. I is equal to I composed with gamma PQ composed with pi. So now I'm thinking of pi as a permutation, as a function from P plus Q to itself. And you see, what we have is that pi of R is equal to S, and pi of S is equal to R. So this says I of R is I of gamma of pi of R, and I of S is I of gamma of pi of S. So the, and that has to be true for every R and S, so the equation just comes down to this. Okay, so now we switch the order of summation. So I sum over all pairings. So this constant stays the same. And here I want to count the number of tuples I1 up to IP plus Q such that I is equal to I composed with gamma composed with pi. This is gamma PQ. Okay, so I just have to, for each pi, I count how many tuples of integers going from 1 up to n I can find that will satisfy this equation. But if you think about it, what is this equation saying? It says that I is constant on certain orbits, the orbits of this permutation. Okay, so on each orbit, I get to choose some number. And then the I is constant on that orbit. And that number can be any number from 1 up to n. On each orbit, I can choose a number independently. So the number of ways of doing it is just n to the number of orbits. Okay. That's what is claimed in the theorem at the top. Okay. Now, when I do the other calculation, when I do the expectations, a product of expectations, okay, well, what happens is I put a parenthesis, another expectation here, so no pairing is allowed to go between the two blocks. So then I get the sum over the disconnected ones. And then I subtract, and I get the sum over the connected ones. And then by this theorem of Jacques and Corey, when I take the limit, I get exactly the number of planar pairings of a PQ annulus. Okay, so I'm going to take the break and come. We'll take a break here and come back, say at 10 after 11. So far we have that theorem over there. Well, it sort of introduces these annular diagrams, but what I want to talk about in the second hour is how to build the theory out of that, this theory we call second order freeness. So, it turns out to really see what's going, you have to go back to this example here, but put some other matrices in there. So let me show you what that means. And then the structure starts to come a little, start to see some structure. Okay, so again, we'll suppose that X is an N by N GUE. And we suppose also that we just have some matrices. Some constant matrices. Non-random matrices. And we make two random variables. Take d1 x, d2 x, dp x, and okay, I'm assuming, let's say I take p plus q of them, okay, and I make another random variable, so I stick all of these constant matrices in between. And then I try and do the same thing. I look at the covariance. Okay, well I get exactly the same formula with one additional variation. Okay, so I'll have to explain the notation a little bit. So keep forgetting that. Okay, so here's the idea. This is going to be a very general bit of notation. So let's suppose we have an algebra and a state. Okay. And I have some elements, A1 up to AN, in my algebra. And I have a permutation of N elements. And I want to define what phi pi of A1 up to AN is. Okay. So before I write down the general formula, let me write down some examples. Okay, so suppose your permutation is just 1, 3, 2, 4. So what that says is I'm going to take phi, and I'll multiply together one A1 and A3, and apply phi to that. And then I'm going to multiply A2 and A4 together, and then apply phi to that. Okay. So if you take a... So in a general case, I'll say this is going to be phi of the cycle. Okay, so let me just write this down first. So if I write pi as a product of cycles, C1 up to CR, we let phi pi be this product of cycles, where phi of a cycle, say the cycle is I1 up to IS of A1 up to AN, is you take the elements in the order that they get visited by the cycle, you multiply them together and apply phi to the result. So this is just an example here. He just burst here. Okay, so that's how you define phi pi. Now over here, I take a permutation. Here it's the product of these two permutations, and the trace is, well, actually it's not a state. Okay, this didn't have to be a state here. So just linear functional. The unnormalized trace is not a state. But I didn't use that here. Okay, so actually there's a nice pictorial interpretation of this result here. Let me put it up on the top. This equation works whether or not the diagram is planar. So let's do a non-planar diagram and a planar diagram. Okay, so here's the idea. Let's draw a connected pairing. Okay, and here's the idea. I'm going to put a D in between the numbers. Okay, and then you can see now there's a question of whether I put D1 here or D1 over here, and I didn't work it out in advance, so this is an unscripted calculation here, and it could be wrong. Okay, so in other words, I think of these as my x's. So let's get rid of these numbers. These are my x's, and I have to connect up the x's. And I put the D's in the blank spaces between the X's, because that's what I did. That's how I did it right here in these two calculations. Okay, and then here's what I do. I say, what is the effect of this pairing? As you see, for each pairing, you get one term. Well, you start over here, and you move around until you hit a line, and you follow the line over, and you come all the way over here, and then you come back again. So according to this calculation, we should get the trace of D1, D3, D6, and that's it. D2 on its own, and then D4, D5, and back again. Okay, so the contribution of this pairing should be the product of these three traces, which is just the same thing as the trace of 1, 3, 6, 2, 4, 5 on D1, D2, D3, D6. Okay, so if this is correct, then it should be that if I let pi be this pairing here, which is 1 and 2, and this is 3 and 5, and 4 and 6, that gamma pi should be this thing right here. So let's put it to the test. So let's multiply it out. So 1 goes to 2, 2 goes to 3. Okay, I got it right. 3 goes to 5, 5 goes to 6. 6 goes to 4, 4 goes to 1. 2 goes to 1, 1 goes to 2. 4 goes to 6, 6 goes to 5. 5 goes to 3, 3 goes to 4. Okay. So it works. Okay. So, if the D's are all the identity matrix, then we're back up, unfortunately, with this calculation that I just erased. But each one of these, for each trace, we just get the trace of the identity. So we just get n to the number of traces, which is just n to the number of cycles in this permutation here. So it's just the original formula. Okay, so okay, so let's turn this into a theorem. Okay. So I want to make a definition about limiting distributions. So I can make this more general, but in this example, I just want to keep it simple. So suppose for each n, we have some not random matrices, just deterministic or constant matrices, and say the number is the same. And an algebra with a state. And elements little d1 up to little ds in A, such that for all polynomials in S non-commuting variables. So a convention is when you put these angle brackets around it, that means that you're assuming the variables don't commute with each other. We have that the limit then goes to infinity of the normalized trace of P of D So you take your non-commutative polynomial and you replace the xi by di, and then you take the normalized trace of that, and that's equal to phi of the same polynomial applied to these elements in your algebra. Okay, if that happens, then we say that this set of matrices has a limiting distribution. Has a limiting distribution D1 up to DF. Now, when we only have one matrix, we talk about some spectral measures and so on. But when you have... Yeah, phi is a state, yeah. Yeah, so if you're using normalized traces there, you want it to be a state, yeah. What was I saying? Well, if you just had a single matrix, we could look at its eigenvalue distribution and assume that there was some limiting measure. Well, when you have non-commuting matrices, there is no limiting measure because you're looking at all possible products. So this is sort of the only thing you can really do, unless you assume some kind of commutivity, because it's only algebraic now. There are some theorems about polynomials in non-commuting random variables with the the converge and stuff like that. But so you could do it if you had a topology on your algebra and take some limits. But at the moment, we're just going to do it at the algebraic level. So this is the non-commuting version of having a limiting distribution. Okay, now we want to apply it in this result here. Okay, so... So if we suppose that our we're back over here where X is a GUE and the D's satisfy that condition there, then we have the conclusion is that when we take a limit here, let's see, where did the so this is equal to the limit as n goes to infinity of the sum over the connected pairings, and I'll take n to the number of cycles of gamma p comma q times pi minus p plus q over 2 times the normalized trace of gamma p comma q times pi of d1 up to dp plus q. Okay, to convert all of those unnormalized traces into normalized traces, I have to divide by something, and this exactly is the amount that I divide by, so I have to compensate by multiplying by it. Okay, so what we know is that this goes to zero unless pi is non-crossing. So only which terms survive in the limit? All of these converge by our assumption, but we they end up getting multiplied by something which goes to zero unless pi is a non-crossing one. So the limit is just the sum over, now I haven't used this notation before, but NC2 P comma Q is just the non-crossing annular pairings. And I'll have phi of gamma PQ pi of D1 up to D P plus Q. Okay, now that's going to be significant because I mean, this is the first sign that something is happening with freeness. I mean, there's some kind of freeness happening here. So let me see if I can... yeah, okay, I guess I'll get rid of that. Okay, because there's a theorem. Another way of stating freeness. Okay, so let me just call this a remark. Suppose A1 and A2 are two subalgebras of an algebra with a state, phi. A1 and A2 are freely independent from each other, or are free if and only if for all A1 up to AN in the first algebra, A1, and all B1 up to BN in the second algebra, we have that phi of A1 B1, A2 B2 up to AN BN can be written as a sum over non-crossing partitions of N elements of phi, of gamma pi inverse, so that will be gamma sub n, of A1 up to AN, times the cumulant kappa pi of B1 up to BN. Okay, so this is a theorem that you haven't seen before, unless you've been reading on your own in the book of Andu and Roland. But this is another way of stating when two things are free. I can't remember if he did this or not. I mean. The Cuevas complement. That's right. Okay. That's right. Okay. So, okay, he did it. Yeah, that's right. Now, I mean, to go backwards, it's actually three things satisfy this relation. So if something satisfies this relation, then they satisfy a free relation, and therefore they must be free. The mixed moments. So that's how you go backwards. So Roland had something which he called the Cuevas complement, which is very similar to this, but it's the pi's on the other side. It's a pi inverse gamma. And that corresponds to the difference between whether you put the D1 up there at 11 o'clock or you put it over where D2 is. It depends how you do the numbering. And, I mean, in this case, it would depend on whether you started with the D's or you started with the exits. So, when I did the calculation, I started with the D's. And then at the end, I realized, okay, well, who cares? Let's just switch the numbering. But anyway, it was too late at that point. So we get this slightly different thing. Okay, but now let's look at this equation. We know the x's converge to a semicircular element. Okay, so if all the b's are equal, okay, then kappa pi of b1 up to bn is something very simple. It's either 1 or 0. It's 1 if pi is a pairing, and it's 0 otherwise. Okay, so and that's because, remember that what the cumulants of a semicircular operator. All the cumulants are zero except kappa 2. So if pi has a block of length other than 2, that will give you a zero. And kappa 2 is 1, so then you just get a product of 1s. So if B is a semicircular, then this formula just becomes the sum over phi of gamma pi inverse of A1 up to AN, and you only sum over non-crossing pairings. Okay, you see that's exactly the kind of formula that we have over here. Except instead of gamma, we have gamma pq. So what this is suggesting is that constant matrices are asymptotically free of second order from Gaussian matrices. Now you can take this a little further. I mean, I made all of these x's the same. But you could have done this. Xi1, I2, I3, that should have been IP. IP plus 1, IP plus 2, IP plus 2, where these numbers where the X's now are chosen from an independent family of GUEs. Okay, same formula would have held, except I have been restricted to pi's that only connect two matrices of the same color. You see, I mean, here I'm imagining I'm coloring my matrices and I'm only allowed to connect matrices of the same color. The colors of the matrix are given by this index. So two matrices of the same color, if the subscripts are the same, they're different colors. So if the set indexes are different. And so that actually, the same calculation again would show that if you take independent GUEs and constant matrices, then you get a whole family which is asymptotically free of second order, whatever that means. And right now it just means that you can do a calculation like this. Okay, so let me now with the 20 minutes left, I'll just give the definition of second order freeness, and I'll say a little bit about what second order cumulants are. But I don't think I can... and that's probably too much already. Okay. So in a sequence of papers, I think we're up to 6 or 7 now, Roland and I and Piotr and Benoit and some others and various combinations of authors have been working through most of the theory that we had in the first six lectures and carrying it over to the second order level. So, the main idea is that you now go up into two dimensions. Some significantly new things happen, but let me try and just give a little summary in the minutes that remain of how it works. So the first thing I have to say is, what is the second order probability space? Okay, so we're starting off with a unit of algebra. A linear functional which takes 1 to 1. Okay, so that's just a regular non-commutative probability space. But now we suppose that we have another linear functional which has a bilinear functional. One other thing. We have to assume that this is a trace. At the moment, we don't have a theory for when it isn't a trace. That doesn't seem to be too painful, because most of the examples that you know it is a trace. But maybe somebody will work out what happens when you don't have a trace. At the moment, we don't know. So you have a bilinear functional that has the property that C2 is tracial in each variable. I think you call this a bitrace. You can cyclically permute the product of entries in either of the variables without changing the value. And it also has the property that if you put the identity into either slot, you get zero, no matter what the other element is. So it always kills the identity. If you put the identity in there, you always get a zero. Okay, and so the second, when we put all this together, we get a second order probability space. Okay, let's see some examples. So we actually have a number of examples, but I think I'll just give two, because they're simple. So these are two examples motivated by certain classic ensembles of random matrices. Let's take our algebra just to be polynomials in one variable. And we're going to think of x as a semicircular element. So we'll say that phi of x to the k is going to be 0 if k is odd. And if k is even, then we're going to take the nth Catalan number. K is 2n, and we let it be the and phi. So this is just the semicircle law. Okay, but now I have to define a phi 2 now. I mean, this is somewhat arbitrary. There's no in principle But there is no connection, though in practice there is you don't want to just do it arbitrarily. But what is the what should I put down for these things? Well, I'm going to take the number of non-crossing pairings of a PQ annulus, because those are the ones that come from a GUE random matrix. Those are connected pairings of an annulus, right? Okay. So the only thing, I mean, this condition, okay, tracial each variable, it's commutative, there's nothing to check. What about this condition? Well, I just define it to be zero if P is zero, because there are no non-crossing connected pairings when you don't have any points on one of the zero. Okay, what about another example? So it's another commutative example. We take polynomials in x and x to the minus 1. Okay, and so now I'm thinking of the of a higher unitary. Okay, so this is the higher unitary example. Okay. And now what about C2? Well, so here I'm going to take the fluctuations that come from a higher distributed random matrix. We calculated 20 some years ago, and you take the absolute value of P times delta PQ. In other words, if P is different from Q, that's zero. If P is equal to Q, you take the absolute value of P. Whoops, that's not right. It should be delta P minus Q. So the sum of the two things has to be zero, otherwise you get zero. Now, both these things are arbitrary, but now you can see something real interesting here. If you take the square of a higher unitary, it's still a higher unitary. But then you would have different fluctuations. Okay, so, I mean, here there seems to be only one natural thing, but if you take any power of a higher unitary, it's still a higher unitary. But the fluctuations are all going to be different if you take the limit that comes from the power of a higher distributed random matrix.
So why is the power of the higher unitary higher?
Well, because the rule for calculating the moments is the same. So, I mean, in the limit, you can't tell the power by after you take the limit, you can't tell what power you were taking. But the fluctuations do remember the power. But the moments don't. Okay. So that's the, those are some examples. Now, so here's a definition of second order freeness. So same situation as before, except in addition to the state, we have this bitrace, a second order probability space. Okay, and we have two subalgebras. The unital, like before, and Now we suppose a bunch of things. The first one is that they're free in the sense that we've been talking about all along, or free of first order. Okay, so free, just mentioned free, as mentioned in the very first lecture. Okay, what's the next thing you need to know is that whenever you have elements A1 up to AP and B1 up to BQ, that either are in A1 or in A2. Okay? And such that... Okay, they have to be centered, just like in the definition... such that okay, since they're all centered. The next thing is they have to be cyclically alternating, which means if A1 is an AJ1, A2 is an AJ2, AP is an AJP, so this is the same as in first order freeness, you multiply to get something, the formula says they have adjacent elements must come from different algebras. So this is the same formula as before. So JP minus 1 is not equal to JP. Now I have to throw in one other condition, which we didn't have to put in the first order case. That JP is not equal to J1. And the same condition on the B's. Then K1 is not equal to K2. KQ minus 1 is not equal to KQ. And KQ is not equal to K1. Okay, if we have all these conditions satisfied, then I can compute what C2 is on the product of the A's, comma the product of the B's. So let me do that over here. Then E2 of A1 times AP, comma, B1 up to BQ is 0 for P different from Q. So if the number of elements is different, then we just get 0. Now, this makes sense because we're assuming that the algebras are, I mean, the elements alternate, and that they're, and the elements, the algebras were free of first order. Okay. Next thing is, if T is equal to Q, then you can calculate phi 2 in terms of just the state. Okay, so this is a little messy. So this is the first order phi, so I take, this is supposed to be a P. I take A1 and I multiply it by BP. And then I take A2 and I multiply it by BP minus 1. So the index of the A's is increasing and the index on the B's is decreasing. And so I get to the end, I get AP times B1. But I'm not finished. Then I rotate the B circle by one notch. And I look at A1, but now I rotate B till I get BP minus 1. You go all the way down until I have AP times BP. And I just keep on going. So the final one will be phi of A1. Now, if you go down this column here, it's BP, B minus 1, so I have to go all the way down to B1. And then it'll be A2, and then we go decreasing, so the next one after 1 is P. And finally I have AP, B2. Okay, and this is true if P is equal to 2 is greater and they're greater than 1. When you just have one element, A1 and B1, then we don't say, then this just says nothing. But it says if you multiply things together in a cyclically alternating way and your elements are centered, then you can reduce this calculation to something involving just the state. If all that happens, then you say they're free of second order. Now, I think it's, I don't want to go, I'll just put the chalk down now and finish up with a few remarks. So, we found what the correct notion of cumulants are in the second order. So that might be the subject of another lecture. But you can say that things are free of second order if mixed second order cumulants vanish. Or if they're free of first order and mixed second order cumulants vanish. We have a bunch of examples. So examples which, okay, everything's been erased now, but if you have independent GUEs and constant matrices, you get things which are free of second order. Now that's actually takes a bit of work to prove. If you have two families of random matrices and you randomly rotate one of them, you get freeness of second order. There's also theorems about Wishart matrices, constant matrices. You get freeness of second order. So in many of the standard examples, we can prove that you get freeness of you get second order freeness if you have independence of the entries and either you have constant matrices or one of the families is in you can rotate it by a unitary matrix without changing the joint distribution of the entries. So those are, then there's actually quite a few more theorems and so on, but that's just a sort of a summary of what, a brief summary of what we can do with second order freeness. So that's it for this.